Okay, Proverbs 27. 27. We did finish up 26 last week. And so let's go ahead and go to the Lord in prayer, and we'll look at a few verses here in chapter 27. Dear Lord, we come to you tonight. Thank you for your blessings. We thank you for this time that we have together around your word, Lord. And we just pray, ask you that you be with the time that we have together this evening, Lord, and just bless it, Lord, for our growth, our betterment, our nearness to you, Lord. And I just pray, ask you that you would just guide and direct me and help me as I teach. I pray, Lord, that you would help us, Lord, to take these truths, this wisdom from your word and apply it to our lives, Lord. I just pray you'd make us wiser people because of it. Help us make better decisions because of it, Lord. And Lord, just walk closer with you. I pray you be with the rest of our church family, Lord, as they're not with us this evening. Just pray, Lord, you just please be with the ones that are working, Lord, the ones that are traveling, different things that's going on, help each of them. And Lord, I just pray, help our church, Lord, to grow. Lord, help us, Lord, to have an impact in this community, how we long to see people saved and desiring to serve you, Lord. And I just pray that you would work in hearts and draw folks to you, Lord, as we've learned about over the past Sundays, Lord, that it is a work that you must do, that you must build your church, Lord. And Lord, we just pray that you would do that, Lord, and use us, Lord, to help in that. And Lord, we just thank you so much for all that you do. In Jesus' name I pray, and amen. Okay, so Proverbs chapter 27 and verse number 1 says, "Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." So what is the most productive day of the week? Most of them, yeah. What is the most productive day in the week?
Every day starting with each day, tomorrow, Tuesdays.
You're getting on the right track. Tomorrow.
Oh.
Tomorrow is the most productive day of the week because that's when you're going to do everything. Well, if we look at the verse that I just read, "Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." So the most productive day of every week is tomorrow, right? And so anyway, today is often squandered because of tomorrow. Because why do today what you can put off till tomorrow, right? And so anyway, either a person is going to be lazy, a procrastinator is going to say, "I'm going to do it tomorrow," right? Or you might have a dreamer who's going to live constantly talking about what they're going to do tomorrow. So it's kind of two different sides of the same coin, isn't it? I don't want to do it today, so I'll do it tomorrow. Or I get nothing done today because I'm making plans for tomorrow. Very similar, right? One's more of a positive thing. I'm planning. I heard someone say a while back that whenever you're still in school, that you can actually impress people by all of your plans. If you tell someone, "I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be a lawyer, I'm going to make it big in my band, or I'm going to get in the movies or whatever," they're like, "Oh, that's awesome." But if you're 40 and you're saying that, not impressive anymore, right? And so there's a limit to your tomorrow. But anyway, that's the way that the dreamer works, is it's going to be great tomorrow. I'm going to do all these things tomorrow. I'm going to strike it rich tomorrow. I'm going to make good decisions tomorrow. I'm going to change things tomorrow. Right? Most productive day of the week. And so a lot of times whenever we keep looking to tomorrow, we end up wasting today and not doing anything today because of what we plan to do tomorrow. Many things you can put off till tomorrow. And if tomorrow doesn't come, it doesn't matter. Right? I know I've often told you that because you're worried about, "I've got to get this done. I've got to get that done." Say, "You can do it tomorrow, and if tomorrow doesn't come, who cares," right? So there's some minor things that you can do that way, things that's not going to matter. But there is a problem that whenever tomorrow does actually come, all those things that you put off are waiting for you there, and your day is quite crowded already, right? And so anyway, things get hectic, and usually there's going to be some necessary things that need to be done that you can't do because you have delayed them too long, right? Or they end up being late. right? I think this verse primarily speaks against taking our days for granted, of thinking that there's always going to be tomorrow, because we're not guaranteed tomorrow. The Bible tells us that life is as a vapor. It appears for a little time, and it vanishes away. And the older you get, the more you realize how true that is and how quickly time passes by. Whether it is a good thing or a bad thing that we are looking to tomorrow for. You know, putting off an unpleasant task or planning to make the next step, whichever way it is. We have no guarantee that that opportunity is going to come, that tomorrow is going to be here. People are going to say, well, tomorrow I will start serving God. Tomorrow I will do some things differently. Tomorrow I'm going to give up this sin, right? Tomorrow I'm going to deal with this. Tomorrow I'm going to have that conversation. Tomorrow I'm going to talk to that person. Tomorrow I will apologize. I'll be okay tomorrow, but today I won't be mad, right? And we put things off till tomorrow. And so we need to do what we can today and do what we should do while we have time. And I believe this is also a great comfort whenever it comes to anxiety, because the Bible tells us in Matthew chapter 6 and verse number 34. Let me see. I'm going to turn over there. It says, take therefore no thought for tomorrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Even in the Lord's Prayer, where it says, give us this day our daily bread, right? We are seeing that there is a time for things. There is a focus that we should have. And if we are focusing so much on a day that may never come and on things that may never happen, we can make ourselves miserable in the day that we actually are in. Mm-hmm. And so we don't need to fret on tomorrow's worries, worry about the things that belong in another day, but we do need to make sure that we are taking full advantage of the day that we do have and doing the things that we should be doing with the day that we've been given. Does that make sense? And so start approaching each day as a gift, seeing it as something that is to be stewarded for God's glory, something that is a blessing from God that we can use each day. And each day as we wake up, choose how are we going to use this day. And just kind of going back slightly on this, if we wake up each day thinking, well, eventually it'll get better, or just after I can get this next thing, or after this next thing happens, we're not actually living in today, and we squander it. Okay, when I get the promotion, right? When I get married, I get this paid off. About just making the best of the day I'm in. Okay, so any questions or comments on that one? I'm trying to think, there was something else I was going to say, but it must have been with a different verse. Yeah, must have been. Okay, verse number 2 then. It says, let another man praise thee and not thine own mouth, a stranger and not thine own lips. So what's this cautioning about?
Bragging.
Okay. Bragging. And so what would be the root of that one?
Pride.
Pride, right? Do what?
Don't be vain.
Yeah, don't be vain. And so I guess the first verse was procrastination. This one's pride. We can alliterate it. And so Solomon's cautioning against self-promotion or pride. Some people wear themselves out patting themselves on the back, right? Ever been around someone who's just always telling you about themselves, always bragging about themselves? It's a tiresome thing, right? Let me tell you what I did. Let me tell you about my family. Let me tell you about my kids. Starting the my horse is bigger than your horse thing. Everything's a competition. Everything is an excuse to try to build themselves up, and usually while tearing everybody else around them down, right? And so anyway, whenever we have people like this, they can do no good thing without publishing it. You've seen the people who are constantly doing charitable things, almsgiving and whatnot, but they're always doing it from a camera. They're doing it for the likes. They're doing it for the population or popularity. I guess technically population, but for popularity, right? They want to be known by the population. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, they're always bragging about themselves. Instead, Solomon tells us to let others do the bragging about us, right? And what others have to say about us is a lot more important than what we can say about ourselves.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't mean that we need to set out in everything that we do it for the praise of men. Because that's another trap, isn't it? Because once again, you do it to be seen of men. You do it to get somebody else to pat you on the back. But it's still for self-promotion, isn't it? We have an epidemic of attention-seeking behavior,
yes.
Right? We have people who are fishing for compliments. Mm-hmm. You got all the pictures that people are putting online, just daring someone to comment on them and boost their ego and their self-image. Tell them how, oh, this is a horrible picture of me. Oh, no, you look great. Right?
Yeah.
And so that's not what this is trying to tell us either. Self-promotion is fueled by our pride. And both of these are seeking validation from other people, okay? What it's doing is I need other people to support my fragile ego. I need other people to tell me how great I am or how pretty I am or however, whatever this I am. And so you're constantly trying some way to build yourself up, right? And so you're seeking for validation from other people. But really, we need our validation from God. Does he love me? Yes. Am I precious in his sight? Yes. Am I living in a way that brings honor and glory to him? That's not necessarily a yes, is it? Because we need to be living for him to say, well done, not for everybody else, right? And so a simple principle here is to put your effort into being someone who is worthy of praise or someone who is worthy of honor rather than trying to receive it. If you're going about just seeking to receive praise or receive honor, you're going to have your focus in the wrong place and you're going to be motivated by the wrong things. But if you just concentrate on living an honorable life, living a life that is praiseworthy, then you'll be on the right track. An honorable person is going to do what's right because it's right, not so that he will receive recognition. Okay? So don't do it for the applause, but do it because it's good.
Right.
Is there any good examples in the Bible of someone who's like that? The only one that's coming to my mind right now, and I know there's more than this, but you remember whenever Nebuchadnezzar had his dream, no one could interpret it. Daniel came in and he interpreted and said, you know, there's going to be this statue and it represents all these kingdoms. And he says, the head of gold is you. Remember that? And so he just makes the entire statue out of gold and then commands everybody to bow down to him, whether they want to or not. And then he ends up eating grass. So, you know, if you can think of anyone in the Bible, that would be a good illustration of that principle. Someone who was just seeking their own validation or seeking everybody else's validation for them. Sure, if you can.
Haman? Samson? Partially?
Okay. Well, Samson was definitely using God's gifts for his glory.
Yeah.
Samson's glory, not God's.
Right.
Haman had some pride and ego issues. He was wanting to be the greatest, and even the whole thing of everyone had to bow down to him and all that, right?
Right.
But even the thing with Haman is a lot better for him to earn the respect rather than demand it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've all been around people that kind of exemplify the difference between that. There's people that we respect because they are respectable. And then there's other people who demand to be respected even though they're not respectable. Which would you rather be? Yeah, you'd rather people choose to respect you rather than you have to go around and say, you know, respect my badge or my uniform or my position, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that counts, but the
one king that was going to go into battle and asked all those prophets to tell him if it was a good idea. And then he had the one prophet brought in that told him not to.
Yeah, I don't like him. He never says anything nice about me, right?
Yeah. He only wanted to hear the good stuff. And then I mocked up the prophet and told him something he didn't want to hear.
Yeah. And you actually brought another one up to mind to me. I don't know if I should say or not. Remember the one where everybody starts praising him and just to make him feel good about himself? They are, what's the word? Do what? Yeah. It was Herod. But what was it that the word for whenever someone says nice things about you that they didn't believe we just talked about last week?
Full of crap.
Do what?
Full of crap.
It is, but there's a word for it. To
flattery.
Do what? Flattery. There you go. For some reason, that word was escaping me. So they were flattering Herod, and he was eating it up.
Yeah.
And so then he got ate up. Is that a good way to put it? He was full of himself, and then then the worms were full of him.
That is too close to home.
Okay. Verse number 3. Verse number 3. A stone is heavy and the sand is weighty, but a fool's wrath is heavier than them both. So what's Solomon telling us here?
When a fool's mad at you, you better be careful, because there's no limits to what they'll do.
Okay, that's a pretty good summary of it, right? Okay. So Solomon's had a whole lot to say about the fool, and I guess this is because foolishness is the opposite of wisdom, right? And Solomon was a wise man. And so whenever he tells about a fool's wrath, he tells us that it is heavy because wrath is an outpouring of anger. We can say, okay, anger is the emotion. Anger is the feeling, right? The Bible says be angry and sin not. But wrath is whenever the anger comes into action. So whenever the emotion actually has some substance to it, whenever it actually does something, that is wrath. And so a fool lacks understanding. So his wrath is going to be poured out indiscriminately. He's not going to have any control or any real thought about how he goes about pouring out his wrath, how he vents his anger. He's going to explode, right? And I think that kind of gives us a little bit of a connection here between a person's condition and their expression. Mm-hmm. If a person is wrathful, if they are constantly blowing their top, it seems to me like the Bible's kind of telling us that they're foolish. Right? And so a fool's not going to care who his wrath impacts. And so there's going to be collateral damage that's created, right? He blows up and he hurts people who didn't hurt him. People who weren't a part of it. His wrath's going to be disproportionate. You hurt me a little, I'm going to hurt you a lot. All right? His wrath is going to continue. He doesn't know when to stop. It's not, okay, I'm going to go and do retribution. I'm going to, you know, a tit for tat and repay you as you have done unto me, is going to escalate, isn't it? Back to Samson again. I think we mentioned him a minute ago. But every time that the Philistines did something to him, he did something worse to them. Right? And it kept escalating and escalating. And so it was a battle of fools, wasn't it? It wasn't like on Princess Bride, they had the battle of wits. They had a battle of fools. Okay, and then a fool's wrath is often triggered unnecessarily. They act without thinking, and so they're angry about things they probably shouldn't be.
Right.
People who have, you know, you've heard of them having a hair trigger or a chip on their shoulder, and they don't actually take the time to process the emotion, they just respond to the emotion.
Right.
They don't think through and say, okay, am I justified in being angry? Am I justified in being this angry? And does being this angry justify this response? It's just kaboom.
Right.
Right? It detonates. And so a man of understanding is going to be sparing with wrath because he does have understanding. He knows that wrath worketh not the righteousness of God, James 1:20. The Bible tells us that God will avenge us, right? Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. And so whenever we give place to wrath, that means that we set back a little bit and allow God to take care of it, right? give place to wrath doesn't mean that, okay, I'm going to schedule my wrath in here. That would be dumb, right?
Okay.
But give place to wrath means, okay, I'm going to restrain myself. I'm going to operate with self-control so that God can deal in wrath, that he can unleash a proper response to what has harmed me, right? Because whenever God does it, he is going to avenge by dealing with the right people. He's going to do it in the right amount. He's going to do it at the right time. And he is going to bring the right result. And if we try to short circuit in any way, what we're going to end up doing is we're going to hurt people that don't need to be hurt. We're going to cause more harm than needed to be caused. We're going to do it, and we're going to mess up the timeline of how things could go together, and it's not going to result in the things that we want. And then at the end, we're more than likely going to feel worse than what we started out with. Because then you have to go back and deal with the mess that you leave behind. And so it says here, a stone is heavy and sand weighty, but a fool's wrath is heavier than them both. And so just to summarize all of that, I think whenever it talks about the heaviness of the wrath, our first thought is to go to whoever they're unloading the wrath on, right? But I think that weight comes back on them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Kind of like verse 27 of chapter 26, whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him. I think the fool's wrath is a weight that he has to bear as well,
yeah,
as all those around him. Okay, any questions or comments on that? Okay, verse number 4. We're still dealing with wrath. It says, wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous, but who is able to stand before envy? Okay? So after talking about the weight and the danger of wrath, he says, just so you know, there's something that's worse than wrath. And it's envy. But I do think envy and wrath go hand in hand. Because oftentimes, envy results in anger, and then it's unleashed in wrath. Is that a pretty good flow chart on that?
Yeah.
Envy or jealousy leads people to do stupid and often violent things. Many murders have been committed because of envy, whether they're envious because someone is doing better than they are, jealous of that person and their lot in life,
mm-hmm,
or because someone got a promotion instead of them, and whether it's at the job or in life, that was supposed to be my life. That was supposed to be my part. I was supposed to be the one in that position. And so you get angry with that person.
Mm-hmm.
You feel slighted. You feel as if you've been wronged by that person, and that's jealousy, and that brings about the anger, and you let it stay and stew and continue to grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually it explodes, right? And there's been plenty of them that's been a result of relationships. If I can't have her, no one can. That's envy, isn't it? You know, the jealous husband, jealous wife. And there's plenty of people in jails because of this. I wonder if you could go through and just kind of analyze the people in jail, how much of it's related back to envy.
Most of it.
I mean, most of the thefts and murders, right?
No.
Okay. What about even like the drug use? How many people are doing it because they don't like their life and they're wanting something different and they think it's going to give it to them? Okay. It was envy that moved Cain to kill Abel. Abel was accepted of God. Cain wasn't. God says, hey, you have the same opportunity as Abel. I don't care. He did better than I did, and I don't like it. I'm going to kill him. It was envy that arranged Abel's murder. It was envy that sold Joseph into slavery. And it was envy that motivated the Jewish religious leaders to kill Jesus. As I've already said, wrath often accompanies envy. And many might blame it sometimes. But here's the thing. Envy isn't as explosive as wrath is. And I think that's what makes it more dangerous. It's not as explosive. Instead, it's subtle. It lingers under the surface. It stays there and festers. It builds, and that's why it's such a danger. Usually with wrath, it's an explosion and it's over with, right? People see the signs, they stay out of the way. But jealousy, as I said, it's subtle. It lingers, sometimes imperceptible. A lot of times, envy and jealousy will cause a person to feign sincerity, act like everything's okay, and then all of a sudden, it is unleashed. And that's where the wrath comes out eventually. But a lot of times people have no clue that it's been festering all that time. And then it comes out. Wrath and anger can be appeased, but envy cannot be. Envy demands that it attains whatever it's seeking. And it's not going to be happy until it seeks it. Until it gets it. Okay, so any comments, questions on envy? I think it's a good instruction for us to be aware of it, because whenever we see any of it starting to creep into our life, it needs to be dealt with exactly. While it's yet small.
Yes.
There was a Patch of the Pirate that had a plant. What was it? Some kind of little plant that was growing and was VeggieTales instead of Patch. Was it envy?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's actually a really good illustration for that, because they had like this little plant that someone planted the seed and it started growing under the ground and it was already taking over everything before they realized.
Doubt and everything like that. All that stuff.
Okay. Okay. So now we're going to get into the section in verses 5 through 10, and that's as far as we'll get today. But this is a section where Solomon's going to give us instruction regarding friends. Okay. So in verse number 5, it says, open rebuke is better than secret love. I said we were talking about friends. We'll see the context of that more here in just a minute. But what kind of people do we like to surround ourselves with? People make us feel good.
It's introverts.
Okay. And so a lot of times we want people who are going to tell us what we like to hear. Uh-huh. Not necessarily what we need to hear. But here it says, open rebuke is better than secret love. Well, for one thing, with secret love, it does no one any good. Love that stays hidden is not going to be beneficial to anyone, right? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, love is hidden because someone won't act. Love is best demonstrated whenever you act for the good of the other person. Whenever you put their needs even before your own. And so then that comes back full circle to the beginning of that, to open rebuke. And one of the greatest demonstrations of love you can have for a person is to confront them whenever they're going astray, when they're going the wrong way. Right? If a person is unwilling to correct you, it shows you that they don't love you that much. They care more about themselves than they do you. They care more about their comfort than they do your welfare. Because if someone won't call out whenever you're doing something wrong, whenever you're doing something that is a hazard or a problem to yourself, but they would rather stay comfortable, it's not much of a friend. It's not much love, is it? And so it takes someone caring a good bit about you in order to call you out. And we don't like to be rebuked. We don't like to be uncomfortable. But we need people in our lives that can call us out, that can correct us whenever needed. And we need to see the value in that and give people permission to call us out. Be willing to accept rebuke. Because I'll tell you, it doesn't matter how much your friends care about you. If they notice that you're a fool and you won't accept rebuke, they'll quit doing it. Yes. And that's more reflection on yourself than it is on them. So it might not feel good at the moment whenever we either have to rebuke someone or we have to receive rebuke from someone, but it's going to make whoever's being rebuked a better person. Okay? If we're being rebuked, it is for us to be a better person. It's also going to reveal the nature of our relationships that we have with others, because if we see someone who feels able to call us out and cares enough to call us out, that's a good friend. And it also shows that we're a good friend because we are welcoming that. And if your friend cares enough to rebuke you and then you bite their head off, you're a bad friend. You're not recognizing the value of that relationship. And so he's seeing here the dynamic that we should have in friendships. We should be able to check each other. We should be able to correct each other. We should be able to call things out and see the value in receiving them, but also see the necessity in giving them and not valuing comfort for either person above. As I already said, a secret love benefits no one, but a needed correction given in love has great benefits. And verse number 6 makes it very simple. It says in verse 6, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." A friend will do what hurts in order to help. An enemy will do what feels good in order to hurt you. Right? You ever have anyone come up and treat you just like, you know, sticky sweet, pour it on real good and they're faking it just to get close to you, just to cause you to have a good impression of them so they can get something from you later on? See, a friend is wanting you to get something from the relationship. An enemy is trying to get something from the relationship. A friend cares about you. The enemy cares about themselves. And a lot of times we didn't recognize the difference. And we've all heard the term frenemies, right? Or friends like you who needs enemies, okay? Someone who claims to be a friend but isn't looking out for your best interests, doesn't care enough to correct you, will tell you things that aren't true just to make themselves feel better or look better, will deceive you in order to get somewhere themselves or to further their agenda. Safe to say they're an enemy, right? But a lot of times, if we're not careful, those are the people we surround ourselves with because they'll say the things that we want to hear, not knowing that it actually causes us damage. Okay, so unfortunately, we like comfort. We want to hear good things that makes us feel good. As I just said, we surround ourselves with the wrong people, and then we end up pushing away the right people, the ones that will hold us accountable, the ones that do want to see us be better in life. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 16, Paul wrote to the Galatians, and he says, "Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Lie to me. Make me feel good. Then I'll keep you around. So you tell me the truth, I'm offended. Get away from me." That what happens a lot of times? In other words, don't be like that. Tell me the truth, even when it hurts, and I know you care, and we can both be better because of it. Okay, any questions or comments on that? Okay, then, verse number 7. It says, "The full soul loatheth an honeycomb, but to the hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet." Solomon knew what it was like to have plenty. He was so wealthy, but then he wrote Ecclesiastes saying all is vanity. He had everything that the world could possibly want, and he looks around, he says, life stinks. That's what happened, right? And so he says here that if you're fat and full, even dessert, even sweets, even, you know, even good stuff is unattractive. You have no appetite even for the things you would normally like because you're already stuffed to the gills, right? So that's kind of where he was financially. And so whenever you have plenty, you take for granted all of these things and you don't appreciate it. A house full of food, nothing tastes good. But if you get a little hungry, anything tastes good, right? That's why you don't go shopping on an empty stomach. Because everything looks good and you bring it home and then you see it in the cabinet and you're like, why did I ever get that? And it's still there 6 months later. Until you're up late one night and you're ravenous and finally it looks good again. Anyway. It It goes a lot more, goes for a lot more than just food. To the poor person, every euro matters. To the rich person, he's not going to waste his time with little amounts, right? You have someone that's broke, they're picking up change off the streets. You have someone who's got plenty, keep the change. They don't want it. They're not going to be bothered with a few euros. They're not going to quibble over that. It means nothing to them, right? To the young person with many days left, it's easy to squander them. But to the man that's been given days or weeks to live, he's going to make every moment matter, isn't he? And it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? You got the same amount of time each day, but to the man that realizes I've only got so many of these days left, I'm going to make each minute I have today matter. Whereas, got our whole life ahead of us. It doesn't matter what I do today. To Solomon, he had so many wives. And so I figure to him, it made it as if none of them were special. You know, after marriage number 257, 258 wasn't special.
That's their way before
men. Right?
Yeah. Special birth.
And so could you imagine Solomon having all of those wives and daily feeling lonely? I mean, it's very real. It would have happened. He would have taken all of them for granted. He'd just be like, I have no real relationship with any of them because I have so many of them. So I don't figure he could ever find a real companion. Now, the book of Song of Solomon, depending on how you read it, it seems as if there might have been a favorite. Right? I don't know. But then also keeping with this thing of friendship, because it seems like this is kind of in the middle of all of this. If you keep it kind of in context, if you're surrounded by a ton of friends, lots of shallow relationships, you're not going to have any of them that are close. You're not going to have any of them that are real deep. But if you just have one or two good ones, then there will be your ride or dies, right? They're going to be special then. And so I think it's a lot better to have a couple solid, good relationships than many acquaintances. I figure Solomon had trouble finding that as well. That's where a friend who or a man who has friends must show himself friendly, right? It's like, I don't know how many close friends I want to have. It's a lot of work. Okay, verse number 8. It says, as a bird that wandereth from her nest, so is a man that wandereth from his place. And I kind of think the key word in that verse is place, right? This verse teaches a principle that is not very popular today. And what it is telling us is that each man has a place and that it is good for him to find his place, get comfortable in his place, and continue in his place. And by comfort, I'm not meaning apathy. I'm saying find your place, accept it, make peace with it, keep in it, right? Because many people today are restless. They're looking for novelty. They're wanting to run from place to place. Not find their place, but they're wanting to find a place. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Their commitment is small. Their contentment is even smaller. Yeah. And so they're looking for the next adventure. They're looking for the next opportunity. In Proverbs chapter 24 and 21, we've already looked at it, but it warned to meddle not with them that are given to change. Mm-hmm. So what that's talking about is they're wishy-washy. They're from bouncing from place to place to place, person to person, relationship to relationship. They're undependable, right? And so we're seeing here faithfulness. We're seeing here continuation. We're seeing steadfastness, right? Yeah. Dependability. And so I think it is a good thing for each person to find their place and stay in it. Find a church, attend faithfully, right? Don't be one of the ones that just bounce from place to place, church hopping, right? Can't ever get in, can't ever get involved, can't ever contribute, can't ever actually receive anything from it because you're not committed to it. Find a spouse, build a life with them. You're never going to build a good relationship with someone if you're bouncing from person to person to person to person to person, right? Find a job and be diligent in it, right? Everybody's wanting their dream job. They're seeing things as just a step to the next place, right? Find something you can do, master it, keep doing it. And that doesn't mean to settle. It doesn't mean just to get an entry job and stay at an entry job for the rest of your life. But also don't have the mindset of discontentment, dissatisfaction, constantly looking for greener pastures. Because what's going to end up happening there is you're never going to be satisfied if you're constantly looking for the escape hatch. Right? So figure out your place. You dive in with both feet and don't jump out the moment it gets hard or it gets boring. Because those are both two things that drive people to the next adventure, to the next place. Whether it gets hard or it gets boring. Sometimes you deal with the hard. Sometimes you deal with the boring, but you continue onward and stay in your place. And sometimes your place changes, right? Sometimes you grow, right? So Solomon says that one that wandereth from his place is like a bird that wanders from its nest. What happens whenever a bird wanders from its nest? Okay. So the bird leaves safety. But what's usually in the nest as well?
Food,
namely, and comfort. Okay. So it's got its eggs, it's got its young in the nest. Whenever it leaves, then it is food for the prey, and its young are left unprotected. Right?
And it's heard of one who eats birds.
Okay. So as the man wanders from his place, he's exposing himself to danger, and he's neglecting his responsibilities, causing harm to those that he cares about. So you think about the man who wanders from his place. Has an affair, right? You have the person who, they may have their job, but they wander from their place. They're constantly just halfway doing it, not putting effort into it. Meddling, messing, right? Not saying this is my place. I'm going to be diligent. I'm going to do a good job here. It's just wandering is the idea of aimlessly, right? You're not traveling somewhere. You're just wandering around. And you leave your spot. You leave what you're supposed to be doing. You abandon your post, right? So this is the idea that's got behind this. Don't be one that abandons your post. Don't be one that leaves your place. Find your place and then get serious about it being your place. Right? Okay. Any questions or comments on that one? Okay. Verse number 9. It says, ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, so doth the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. So we all understand what perfume is, right? You like smelling a nice perfume, right? You ever been walking down the street and you smell someone's perfume or your cologne, you're like, well, that's a nice smell. Does it ever put a smell or a smile on your face? It's like, oh, that's nice. You smell a flower, right? And so that smell elicits almost an emotional response, doesn't it? Polite smell, polite odor. And we know the opposite of that as well. So here he's saying that we can be that pleasant scent, that pleasant smell to a friend by hearty counsel. Good advice, right? And so he's letting us know that true, deep, meaningful friendship is the result of relationship, not recreation. And what I mean by that is a lot of times we think friends are the ones that we do stuff with. Right? But real friendship is built not in doing stuff, but in going through stuff.
Exactly.
Does that make sense? When I was talking about hearty counsel, this is someone that I can go to when I'm in the thick of it and say, hey, I need your help. I'm going through this. What do you have to say about this? And then they can help shoulder that burden. They can give you reassurance. They can give you some direction. And they can actually help you to feel better as you are going through maybe a time of difficulty or your time of decision or whatever. Someone you can come alongside of, and they're willing to go through it with you. Mm-hmm. And it's refreshing. It's like that good scent, that good perfume coming in. Mm-hmm. Because I've got someone who is willing to make a stinky situation smell a little better.
Yeah.
That makes sense? Mm-hmm. And so it's sharing life in all of its complexities, not just the good times. Mm-hmm. Because if you have someone, when things start to stink, they flee. Not a good friend. But whenever things start to stink, they come in and make things smell a little better. Mm-hmm. Good friend. And so sweetness in the friendship is bearing one another's burdens, guiding through difficulties. The best relationships are the ones that have carried one another through hard times and counseled one another through many difficult decisions. It's great whenever you have friends that are able to help one another, where you can bear each other's burdens, where you can go back and there's times that they carried you and times that you carried them. Times that you didn't know which way to go and they were able to speak some life and wisdom into it. And then times they didn't know and you were able to do that for them. Right? The joy that comes from having someone that you can call on and, like I said, say, I need help. What do you think I should do? Knowing that they've got your back and they're going to tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. That's reassuring, that's strengthening, that's refreshing to a person, right? Mm-hmm. I know I can count on this person, right? And so in verse number 10, continues this thought. It says, thine own friend and thy father's friend, forsake not, neither go into thy brother's house in the day of thy calamity, for better is a neighbor that is near than a brother far off. Okay? So this is telling us with the importance of friends, we need to be cultivating relationships and keep them going. In the first part of that verse, it says, thine own friend and thy father's friend, forsake not. Mm-hmm. So these are friends that's been around for a while. Yeah. Not just your friends, but your father's friends. It's like, these are family friends. These are people that we've known forever. Don't take those lightly. Don't abandon those relationships. You're going to need those. And not just not abandon them, make sure that you are cultivating into them and you're continuing to build them, because you need people who know you and you need people who are around you. You need people who are close to you. It's hard to cultivate relationships with people who don't know you and people who don't know your situation, that don't know your culture, that don't know what's going on in your vicinity. It's a lot easier to build relationships with people who are in the same place, right? And it says, for better is a neighbor that is near than a brother that's far off. Mm-hmm. And so here it's saying that you build relationships. You can choose, kind of the thought that I'm looking at here is, you know how often we've talked about how we're closer to people who we're not related to by blood? That's what it's telling here. You can build relationships with people, bond with them, lift one another up, be able to have people that you can fall back on in times of adversity, not because they have to, but because they want to. That's what it's saying in verse 10. It says, neither go into thy brother's house on the day of calamity. World falls apart. Okay, I can always go back to my family, even if I've not talked to them, even if I've had nothing to do. We're related by blood. They're obligated to take me in, right? It's saying don't depend on them. Be building relationships with people who's actually going to desire to help you rather than be required to help you. Does that make sense? And so you're far better to build relationships than to bank on relations. Okay? I've got people that I know have my back in this. We're not related by blood. We've been through some things. And I know if everything falls apart, I can count on them. Right? I'm not going knocking on family and say, hey, you birthed me. You're required to take me in. Now, doesn't mean that family can't be that relationship. But it's saying that you need to be pouring into a relationship, building relationships, so that you have those in the day whenever things fall apart. Okay. So he's not against actually liking your family and having a relationship with your family. But he's saying it better be because of a relationship rather than just blood. And I think verse 10 is even more sad whenever we realize that Solomon writing it and what happened to Rehoboam. Because he forsook his father's friends, didn't he? Anyway. And that entire section that we looked at, in the ones that he listened to, the ones that he prized, the advice that rang true for him, went against all the advice his father had given him, right? Okay. Any comments or questions on what we looked at this evening? Okay, then.